dear Lord, a lesson to be learned, and one that we must never forget if we wish to maintain paid-up insurance policies against our drinking. You recall the story about Bill having had some spiritual experience, having been sold on the idea of attempting to be helpful to others. You undoubtedly recall the fact that he had been working quite hard at it for around 5 months or so, almost incessantly, and still had not created, if you please, a single convert. Not one. As we express it, no one had jailed. But he had worked tirelessly, with no thought of saving his own strength or time or anything. But nothing seemed to register. When he came off to Akron on this business mission, which perhaps for the good of all of us turned out to be quite a flop, although he had the thing licked but didn't know it, he was tempted to drink. He was pacing up and down the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, wondering whether he better buy those two fists of gin and be a king for a night, as he expresses it, or not. And his teachings led him to believe that he possibly might avoid getting into difficulties if he found some alcoholic on whom to work. Spying the name of our good friend, Reverend Walters, on the bulletin board in the lobby of the Mayflower, he called up the good doctor and asked him the names of some of the group of people with whom he had been affiliated and through whose instrumentality he had acquired sobriety. The good doctor said he wasn't one, but he knew of quite a number, and he gave him quite a little list, I guess about 9 or 10 of them. So Bill stopped to call them up without very much success. They had either just left town, or they were just leaving town, or they were having a party, or they had a short call or something. Anyway, he came down to the end, or at least very nearly the end, and his eye lights on the name Mrs. and happened to get our good friend Henrietta. But he called up our good Henry and told her what he wanted, and she said, "Come right out and have lunch with me." So out he went, and went into his story in considerable detail, and she said, "I have just the man for you." So she rushes to the farm and calls up Anne and tells her that she has just the fellow to be helpful to Bob, that we should come over. And he says, "Well, I guess we better not go today." But Henry is very persistent, very determined individual. He said, "Oh, yes, tomorrow. I know it'll be helpful, Bob." Well, Henry didn't think it was quite wise for us to come over there. And finally, Henry bore in to such an extent that she had to tell her that I was very much in the sack. And in fact, it passed all the capabilities for listening to any conversation, and it would just possibly have to be postponed. So she starts in the next day, having invited being Sunday and Mother's Day, and we said that Anne said we would be over. Well, I don't ever remember feeling much worse, but being very very fond of Henry, and having said we'd go over, we started over, and I extracted the solemn promise, man, on the way over that 15 minutes of this stuff was top. But I didn't want to talk to this mug or anybody else, and we'd really make it snappy. Now, these are actual facts. We got there at 5 o'clock, and it was 11:15 when we left. Now, you know, well, possibly your memories are good enough to carry you back to certain times when you haven't felt too good, and you can easily visualize the fact that you wouldn't have listened to anybody unless that individual had really had something to tell you. And that's the way I felt about Bill. And I recognized the fact that he did have something, and so I listened those many hours. And I stopped drinking immediately. But very shortly after that, there was a medical meeting in Atlantic City. And I developed a terrific thirst for knowledge. I had to have knowledge. So I would go to Atlantic City and absorb lots of knowledge. I usually mention the fact that I incidentally had acquired a thirst for scotch, but I didn't mention that. But anyway, I went to Atlantic City and really hung one on. And when I came to, I was in the home of a friend of ours in Cogger Falls, one of our suburbs. And Bill came over and got me home, gave me a hooker or two of scotch that night and a bottle of beer the next morning. And that was on the 10th of June of 35, and I have had no alcohol in any form that I know of since. Now, the interesting part of all this, and not all these sordid details, but the condition that we two fellows were in. We had both been associated with the same bunch of people. He in New York and I in Akron. I had been associated with them, in fact, for 2 years and a half. He for 5 months. He had acquired this idea of service, and that I had not. But I had done an immense amount of reading, which they recommended. I had refreshed my memory on the good book, and I'd had an excellent training in that as a youngster. They told me that I should go to their meetings regularly, and I did every week. They said I should affiliate myself with some church, and we did that. And they also said that I should cultivate the habit of prayer. And I did that, at least to quite a considerable extent for me. But I got tight every night. And I mean that, certain once in a while, it was practically every night. And I couldn't understand what was wrong. I had done all these things that these good people told me to do. Every one of them. And I thought very faithfully and sincerely, but I still continued to overindulge. But the one thing that they hadn't told me was the one thing that Bill had. The instruction to attempt to be helpful to somebody else. So we immediately started to look around for prospects, and it wasn't long before one appeared in the form of a man whom you all know, at least a good many of you know, a good friend of Akron. Now, I knew that this Bill was Sunday school superintendent. And I also thought that he probably forgot more about the good book every night than I ever knew. And who was I to be trying to tell him about it? And made me feel somewhat hypocritical. It is quite a charm for me to talk to him on that sort of subject. But anyway, we both did, and I'm very glad to say the conversation fell on fertile ground. Then in October, we had three dumped in our laps almost simultaneously. But the point I wanted to bring out was the fact that that in my mind, the spirit of service is of prime importance, although it has to be backed up with some knowledge of the subject. I know I used to go to the hospital and I'd stand there and talk. I talked many a time to a chap in a bed for 4, 5, or 6 hours. I don't know how he ever stood me for 5 or 6 hours, but he did. Probably with hidden clothes or something. But anyway, it came to my mind that I probably didn't know too much about what I was talking. Therefore, we being stewards of what we have, and that includes our time, I was not giving a good account of my stewardship of time. If it took me 6 hours to say something to this man that I could have said in an hour, we'll say, if I'd known what I was talking about, I certainly was not a very efficient individual. And incidentally, I'm somewhat allergic to work anyway. So, I felt that I should continue to increase my familiarity not only with the good book, but read a good deal of good standard literature and possibly something of scientific interest along with it. So I did follow this habit of reading, and I think I'm not exaggerating when I say that I have probably averaged to read an hour a day for the last 15 years. Now, I don't say that to try to sell you on the idea that you've got to cultivate that habit of reading an hour a day, because there are plenty of people in fine AAs that don't read very much. You see, back in those days, we were groping in the dark entirely. We did not know much about it. We knew practically nothing of alcoholism. I, a physician, knew nothing about it to speak of. Oh, I'd read about it, but there wasn't anything worth reading in any of the textbooks. And usually the information about it consisted on some queer treatment for DTs. If you're down that fire, and if you hadn't, why, you prescribed a few bromides and gave the fellow a good lecture. None of which, of course, amounted very much. And in early AA days, we became quite convinced that the spiritual program was fine, but we could help the Lord out a little with some supplementary diet. So, in the early days, Bill, having a lot of stomach trouble, had stumbled across the fact that he got along much better on sauerkraut and cold tomatoes. And so we thought that inasmuch as Bill had to have that experience, that probably everyone else would share the same. But of course, we discovered later that the most any dietary restriction have very little to do with the acquisition and maintenance of permanent sobriety. We, in our own story, didn't amount to anything to speak of. When we started in on Bill, we had no 12 steps, we had no traditions, we had nothing of that kind. But we were convinced that the answer to our problem was in the good book. And it became somewhat evident, we thought, to some of us older ones that it was contained, the part that we found absolutely essential, to a rather limited section of the good book. In other words, the Sermon on the Mount, 15th chapter of Corinthians, and the book of James. I think we got those ideas pretty firmly implanted in our minds very early. And we had in those days, our membership got to 5 and 7 and 10 and still small. We used to have daily meetings in somebody's house. It was probably providentially arranged that all this happened at a time when everybody was broke, and awfully broke, too. It was probably much easier for us to be successful when broke than it would have been to have been successful if we'd had a good checking account apiece. But I know that we were, every one of us, just so painfully broken. Well, it wasn't a pleasant thought. But nothing could be done about it, and everybody else was broke too, and so we didn't take it too much to heart. But I do think that was providentially arranged. But anyway, we kept on having these meetings and having these discussions and attending the meetings of these good people with whom we had been associated, and did continue to have them with them until, in Akron I'm talking about, of course, until about 40, or maybe early in 41. Might have been January 41, I don't recall the exact date. When we outgrew the relevance of this good friend who allowed us to bang up the plaster and the door jams, the counting chairs up and down the stair, and he had a very beautiful home. We had outgrown that, and so we stepped out and in a short time acquired the rental of the auditorium in the King School, and I'm talking about the group that I attend personally, have been there ever since. We attempt to have a good meeting, and I think we're usually successful. But it wasn't until 39 that the teachings and efforts and studies that had been going on were crystallized in the form of the 12 steps. I didn't write the 12 steps. They had nothing to do with the writing of them. I think probably I had something to do with them indirectly, because after this June 10th episode, Bill came to live at our house and stayed for about 3 months. And there was hardly a night in that 3 months that we didn't sit up till 2 or 3 o'clock discussing these things. And it'd be hard for me to conceive that something wasn't said during those nightly discussions around our kitchen table that influenced the actual writing of the 12 steps. They're much more handy to have in that form, of course. We had the ideas pretty much basically, but not in terse and tangible form. We got them, as I said, as a result of our study and effort of the good book. must have had them because we have learned from experience that they are very important in maintaining sobriety, and we were maintaining sobriety. Therefore, we had them, but not in exactly the written form as you know them now. But that was the way that things started off in Akron. And as we grew, we began to get offshoots. First one was in Cleveland. And I don't remember the next one, but anyway, they all started in Akron not too long after that. And have been continuing ever since. It was a great source of satisfaction to me to feel that I may have played some part in taking in my two bits toward getting this thing started. I like to think that I have done that. Maybe I'm taking too much for granted. I don't know. But I feel that I was simply used as God's agent. I feel that I'm no different from any of you fellows, girls, except that I was a little more fortunate that I got this message 13 and a half years ago, and some of you have to wait till a little later. In fact, I got a little teased at our Heavenly Father because he was a little slow on the trigger, because I thought I would have been ready to receive it quite a while before he got around to present it. And that used to irritate me no end, but after all, maybe he knows better than I. But I felt sure that I would have been glad to have anything presented that would have been workable and produce the sobriety which I thought, at least, that I wanted so badly. I used to even doubt that at times. I would go to my good friend Henry and say, Henry, do you think that I want to stop drinking with you? Henry, being very charitable, thought that, yes, Bob, I'm sure you want to stop. And I would say, well, I can't conceive of any living human who really wanted to do something as badly as I think I want to do it, who could be so total a failure. But Henry, I think I'm just one of these wander guys. He said, no, Mom, I think you want to. We just haven't found just the way to work it yet. But anyway, that was the way I felt about it. And because of my sobriety has been maintained continuously for 13 and a half years, it doesn't allow me to think that I'm necessarily any farther away from my next drink than any of you people here. I'm still very human, and I still think that a double scotch would taste awful good. And if it didn't produce disastrous results, I might do it. I don't know. I really love scotch. But I have no reason to think that it would taste any differently. I have no legitimate reason to believe that the results would be any different. They were always the same. They were always the same in that I always wound up back at the dear old baseball somewhere. And I have no precedent or anything to make it feel legitimate for me to believe that the results today would be any different than they were 14 and 20 and 25 and 30 years ago when I did the same thing. I just don't want to pay that bill, because that's a big bill. It always was, and I think it would be even larger today, because of what has gone on in the last 15 years. I'm naturally being a bit out of practice. I don't believe I'd really last very long, and I'm really not the last time. And I just don't want to bump myself off, even with the pleasures of the alcohol route. Well, I'm not going to do it. And I'm never going to do it. As long as I do the things that I'm supposed to do. And I know what those things are. So if I should ever get tired, I certainly never would have anyone to blame for it. It would be done, perhaps not with malice before that, but it certainly would be done with as a result at least of extreme carelessness and indifference. I said I was quite human, and I get to thinking every once in a while, well, if this must die, he's a very smart individual. He's got this little situation right for the tail, proved it, demonstrated it, hasn't had a drink for 15 years. Probably could knock off a couple, and no one would be the wiser. Well, I'll tell you, I'm not trying to be funny at all, because those thoughts actually enter my mind. And I never get a minute to do exactly what has happened. You see, there in Ashton, we have the extreme good fortune that we get many of you people know of having a very nice hospital set up at King Thomas Hospital. There's a wall that theoretically accommodates 7, but the system basis is that it stretched a little bit, and she usually has about 2 or 3 more packed around somewhere. And I almost invariably I find that I haven't been paying quite so much attention to the boys in the ward as I should. Just to say that idea that I could probably polish off a couple enters my mind. I think, about the boys in the war. You've been giving them the semi-brush off here for a few days. You better get back on the job, big boy, before you get into trouble. And I've had a right back and am much more attentive than I had been in the preceding the time that I got this funny idea. But I get it, and I get it every once in a while, and I'll probably continue to get it as long or whenever I get careless about that one thing. You know, back in those early days about which I spoke, before we had the 12 steps, we did have some other things besides the actual biblical verses. I was getting to thinking more of Smith than I was the Lord, otherwise I wouldn't have been neglected. And I wasn't being especially loving when these fellows would come there, indicating their desire for help, and I was just a little too busy to give them any or at least very much of my time. So I'd be bothered with the boys. 10 cents to get rid of him, why, that's easy. You could even stand 2 bits. But not because you love the father, just to be relieved of the nuisance of his hanging on your quick sleeve or what have you. No unselfishness, no law indicated in the transaction at all. But I think that the thing that really counts is really giving a service of yourself, and that almost invariably, not always, but almost invariably requires some effort and some time of your own. It isn't a matter of putting a little quiet money in the dirty. That helps, and possibly that's indicated too. But that isn't giving much. That is for the average individual in days like this when most people get along at least fairly well. That type of giving I don't believe ever keeps anyone sober or anywhere near it. But giving of his own effort and strength and time is quite a different matter. And I think that's what is meant by, and what was meant by what Bill learned in New York that I didn't get in Akron. Matter of those four absolutes we call them, the only yardsticks we had in the early days, I think they still hold good. And I still think that they can be extremely helpful. I found at times that questions arise and I want to do the right thing, but the answers are not obvious. You know what the right thing is. But almost always, if you check it into it carefully, by the yardsticks of absolute honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love, and whatever your decision is, checks up pretty well with those four, your answer can't be very far out of the way. If, however, you do that, as I have done at times, and still am not too satisfied with the answer, I usually consult some friend whose judgment perhaps I think in this particular case would be very much better than mine. But usually you can do it yourself without bothering your friends about your own personal decision in overcoming the first step. Can't quite get honest enough to admit that John Valicon really has bested us. The matter of absolute purity is somewhat like it, with purity of ideas and purity of motives and what have you. Non-selfishness includes those things that I've just been talking about, not the dime or the 2 bits to the bump, but actually giving of yourself. And as you well know, the absolute love is probably a big word incorporating all three or a little bit more along with it. I think that that is a very difficult thing to have, absolute love. I don't think any of us will ever get it. But that doesn't mean that we can't try to get it. It is extremely difficult for me, and I feel that I never have been very successful at it. It's very difficult for me to love my fellow man. I didn't dislike him, but I didn't love him. Unless there was some special reason, he was just, I was just indifferent toward him. I wouldn't do him any harm. I would be willing to give him a little lift if it didn't require too much effort. I never would injure him at all. But to love him, I just couldn't do it for a long time. And I think that I overcame it to some extent when I was forced to do it. Because I was either going to love this bird or not to attempt to be helpful to him, or I would probably get tempted. You could say, that's just a manifestation of selfishness, which is quite correct. I was selfish to the extent of not wanting Smithhead. So to keep from getting Smithhead, I would attempt to go through the motions of being helpful to this telephone. You can debate it any way you want to, but the fact still remains, for the average individual, absolute love is a thing that he will never acquire. I suspect there are a few people who do. I think maybe I know some that come pretty close to it. That I think I could count them on the fingers of one hand. I don't say that in a disparaging manner, because I have some wonderful friends. I'm talking about it in its finer aspects, and particularly as it applies to AA. I don't think we do anything well or very probably we do AA work too well unless we practice it. Two fellows that win great world records in athletic events, people who win the titles in the boxing arena, are people who practice it. They've been practicing it for years. Even though they may necessarily be endowed with a lot of physical ability and skill, they still have to practice. And we have to practice to do a good job in AA. And there are a number of things that we should practice. We should practice, as I say, acquiring the spirit of service. We should attempt to acquire some faith, which isn't always easily done, especially for the person who's always been very materialistically minded. And those are the standards of society today, beyond all doubt and peradventure. You have $1 million, and your neighbor has 900 grand, you're a much better man than your neighbor, to the extent of $100,000. And so forth and so on, and nothing. But I think that it can be acquired. It can be acquired slowly. I think that is something that has to be cultivated also. That was not easy for me. I just assume it's difficult for others. Another thing that is difficult for me, and I probably don't do too well yet, and that is the matter of power. In time, to have closed minds, they're pretty tightly closed. And that's one reason that some people find spiritual teaching difficult. They don't want to find out too much about it. For various personal reasons. One reason is the fear of being considered effeminate, just for illustration. But anyway, the matter of tolerance toward the other individual's ideas, it's quite important that we do acquire it. I think I've acquired it. I have much more of it than I did have. Well, not enough to hurt me any yet. Because somebody crossed me, why I was asked to make at least a rather caustic remark about it, which I've done many times, much to my regret. And later on, I find that the man knew much more about it than I, and I've been infinitely better off if I just kept my big mouth shut. Another thing with which most of us are not overly blessed, and that is the dealing with humility. I don't mean the in the sense that Dickens, you are a heap at all. I don't mean the doormat variety. I don't think we're necessarily called on to be shoved around and stepped on by anyone, and we have a right to stand up for our rights. I'm talking about the attitude of each and every one who is toward our Heavenly Father. Christ said of myself, I am nothing. My strength cometh from my Father in heaven. And if he had to say that, how about you and me? But did you say it? Did I say it? No. That's exactly what we didn't say. We were inclined to say, well, look at those boys. Pretty good, huh? That type of attitude. But there's no humility. No sense of having receive anything through the grace of our Heavenly Father. So if I accomplish something, either in AA activity, or socially, or in my profession, I don't believe I have any right to get cocky about it. It's only through God's grace that I do it. I can feel very thankful that I was so weak to do it, to have the recognition which I may have received for some activity. But basically, it was only through his kindness. And my strength does come from him, and these things come as a result of his kindness. Who am I to get cocky about it? I should have a very, very humble attitude toward the source of my strength. And I should also never cease to be grateful for whatever feelings come my way, blessings come my way. And I have been blessed, and I've been blessed in very large measure. You know, it doesn't make much difference whether a person is drinking or whether they're sober as far as their ultimate aim is concerned. Whether they're drinking with it or whether they're not, they still act for the same thing, and that's happiness and peace of mind. I harp about that a great deal because that's what we're all after, and we're all after all the time. We want those two things. We want happiness and we want peace of mind. The trouble with us fellows was that we thought we could demand that the world give us happiness in just the particular way in which we wanted to get it, which happened to be by the alcohol route. And we weren't always successful. But when we take time to find out and familiarize ourselves with and put into practice some of the spiritual laws which it is necessary to follow to acquire those things, then we find that we get them. And I think I've had them in very large measure. Those two things, happiness and peace of mind. And I feel most extremely fortunate, and I feel very grateful and thankful that our Heavenly Father has seen fit that I enjoyed it. So there, anybody can get them who wishes to, but there do seem to be some rules of the game that we have to follow. But they're here and open and free to everyone who wishes to take advantage of them. And by taking advantage of them means their familiarization with them and putting them in practice and incorporating them in our own thinking and action, and we're bound and determined to get certain results if we do. As I said, it is a very great source of pleasure and gratitude to me to feel that maybe I kicked in my two bits toward starting it. But as I said also, I feel that I was simply used as God's agent. The question might arise, well, we know what Eddie's done in the last 15 years, but how about it from here on? Where do we go from here? My membership, I think, is conservatively estimated at present around 70,000. Whether it will be an increase from here on, well, that will depend on every member of AA. It is possible for us to do so or not, as we elect. If we might shy of what the political style entangling alliances, if we avoid getting messed up with controversial issues such as religious and political issues, wet and dry problems and so forth, if there's no unity to our central office, if we remember the simplicity of our program, if we continue to remember that our job is to get sober and to faithful and to help our less fortunate brother in doing the same thing? I doubt very much if we shall have any trouble, and we shall continue to grow and thrive and prosper. And I hope we all bear those good things in mind. Maybe there should be some additions to the list, but that roughly covers it fairly well.
Because a contracting heart, he'll never refuse to help and give him the grace he needs. I feel that it's a privilege to work in this field. I owe much to my community. When Bill called me about this, I certainly could hardly think of appearing on a program like this. And as I said, well, it's something like the AA third step. We turn our life and our will over to God under the direction of our superior. My superiors might have sent word at any time that I was to take no more. It came nearly to that point in a few cases. But thank God, and the fervent prayers of, well, I suppose many of the sisters who were interested, and our beloved Dr. Bob and Bill himself, somehow we weathered it through. I'll just, Bill asked me to say a few words about how we got started in Aspen. I hardly know myself. I was sent there in 1928 just as a, well, it might be the doctor recommended occupational therapy, change of occupation for a while. I was in the field of music, and as you know, that's rather nerve-wracking. And a change might be good for me. So I was sent to St. Thomas, which was just opened in 1928. And it was there I met Dr. Bob. We had an open staff the first year because we didn't know the men, nor did they know us. Doctor operated at our hospital and the other hospitals. I didn't know the drinking problem, and in fact, I wouldn't have known it had he not told me so, because he didn't come to the hospital when he was drinking, evidently. Oh, I can recall sometimes his voice was rather reverberating. I could hear him when he came in the back door. He had a decided English accent, New England accent. But I liked him because he was so straightforward. Those of us working on hospitals know that some doctors make everything an emergency, a matter of life or death. Others will tell you the exact truth about the case. Say, well, my patient's waited a few days, or if they can't, then you know that you take them for what they say. However, the doctor was so straightforward that I enjoyed working with him. And one day he looked rather down. We often had little chats. And this morning he came, he looked rather down. I said, "Doctor, what's the trouble this morning?" Well, then he told me. He said, "Well, sister," he said, "I might as well tell you that I came in contact with a New York broker and I've had a drinking problem for a long time, and somehow we got together and we've all tried to work out something that will help these drunks," he said. Well, he said, "We've been trying it out. They tried a few rest homes, and he had some in the other hospitals. And he said, "Sister, would you consider taking one?" Well, I hesitated because sometime before, probably some months before, I took a man in who Oh, he looked, I didn't know much about this drinking. I knew some could drink. Some could drink and handle it well, and others couldn't. So they called me to the emergency, and I went down and talked with him. Oh, he said, just if I could just lie down a little while. He worked at the city garage and looked like a very respectable person. He said, I've been drinking a little too much, and I want to get straightened out, which I thought was a good thing. Well, the only bed that we had at the time was a bed in a four-bedroom. Then we knew nothing about special treatment. And I signed into the man on service, on medical service, and registered him, put him to bed, and I said, you won't cause any trouble. Oh, no, he'd be an angel. Well, I forgot about him. When I came over early the next morning, the night supervisor, who was tall, sister, we always teased her about her big feet. Well, she was standing at the door waiting for me. She said, the next time you take a DT in this place, please stay up all night and run around after him as we have. That wasn't the end of it either. I decided then that's enough. I often felt sorry to see them turned away, but I was not the last word in the hospital. So when Doc proposed my taking a real, as I thought a real, well, you can imagine my misgivings. I said, oh, dear me. I told him about this experience, and I said, Doctor, not only will I be put out, but I said, the patients and everything else. I said, I don't think they want alcoholics. He said, sister, this patient won't give you a bit of trouble because I will medicate him, I'll assure you. Well, I had much confidence in him because he never said anything that wasn't so. I'll always say that. Well, very fearfully, I said, well, doctor, I shall take him then. And put him in a two-bedroom. I thought I was doing pretty well because we were so crowded in those days. And beds were rather premium. So I took him to this two-bedroom. Doctor went up and medicated him and everything. And I thought, well, I figured I wouldn't hear much till the next morning anyway, if there was any trouble. So there was a word about it. Doctor then came to the admitting office. Thank you. He said, sister, would you mind putting my patient in a private room? I thought I had done pretty good to put him in a two-bed. He said, you know, there'll be some men come to visit him, and they'd like to talk to him privately. Well, I said, I'll do what I can, doctor. After he left, I went up and looked the situation over. And right across the hall, we had a flower room where we used to prepare the patient's flowers. And I thought, well, they can fix their flowers somewhere else for today, and I believe I could push the bed in there. That's what we did. And his visitors came. We kept a close eye on them. I did. It was all you. And I thought, well, my, the respectable-looking men, they don't know that they ever took a drink. And went along. I thought, now, the next time, I won't have this trouble, and I'll put him in a private room. So the next one that came along, I put in a private room. And I didn't know much about these alcoholics. I was not an expert. Surely the Lord picked out a weakling when he picked out me, I know. But, however, I took him down to the room, as I would any patient, and then was taking the chart to the desk. to explain to the nurse a little about it. I couldn't tell her too much. But said Dr. Bob would give her the orders. And wasn't he down after me? Well, he had his short tongue and everything else. I nearly went through the floor because the nurses all looked and everyone. And you go right back to your room, be right down. So the nurse came down with me. And here he was under the bed. Well, I thought this will never work. I don't believe this will go at all. I'd better put two together the next time. I didn't want to give up at once. I don't know just exactly what I did, whether I had someone stay with him or what I did. But I know after that, I put two together and then finally took a four-bedroom. That seemed to go pretty good. One would help the other. Usually, one or two would be in a few days before they'd be coming out of it pretty well. And so then we took another two-bed across the hall. Well, it was hard to say no when they really wanted to do something about it. And by that time, the men were coming in quite often. So much so that some of the sisters said, "Who are these fine-looking men that come in so often and seem so interested in the patients?" And I didn't say much at first, but later I said, "Well, that is AA." I said, "What is AA? Would you like to know something about it?" "Well, yes." "Well, I'll bring some literature then." I gradually got them. But, of course, before that, a committee from Alcoholics Anonymous talked with Sister Superior. She was one who had a lot of experience in the old days of charity and all. And she knew what we were doing. And she said to these men, she said, strange, she said, when we had them at charity, they'd be running around the halls and doing a lot of trouble. But since Dr. Bob is treating them, we don't know that they're in the house. So she said, "There's no problem. As far as I can see, just go right along." Well, that was wonderful. But that wasn't all. Of course, then later the patients complained because they couldn't have visitors at any time. As these AAs did, they seemed like such privileged characters. So finally, they decided to... We had a small accident ward. It was sort of off from the rest of the hospital. And there we put in a coffee bar and Dr. Bob set up the program. I want to tell you that the first opportunity he had, he brought Bill over. And, of course, I couldn't imagine who this wonderful Bill was. But I soon learned that God had chosen two great men. What one didn't have, the other supplemented. And together, they were perfect. I could just see, I often say to our boys, had God picked out two great religious leaders, no one would have come near them. Because the alcoholic doesn't want anything about religion or God, nor do we try to preach religion to them. But they aren't in very long until they're asking or telling you what experience they've had and what they'd like to do. They know they haven't been living right. And I feel that, as many of our nurses have said, the best sedative is peace of mind. If once they can be relieved of their anxieties and worries and treated properly, there should be no trouble. First, when we first come in and Dr. Set up the program, no televisions, no radios, no newspapers, only literature pertaining to AA or something that would have a building of their morals and things of that kind. Because they have all the reading they can take care of, and then their visitors, too. Well, we went on with that. There are many details I could bring in, but I don't want to make it too long because I know many of you have probably questions that maybe Colonel Towns could answer in some of these People who know much more than I. But anyway, during Doctor's time, I think we treated before between 4,000 and 5,000. And he treated them. He came in every day unless he was out of town or something like that. And without any charge, he said, that's my contribution to AA. Of course, in those days, they didn't have too much either to start with. And you couldn't mention money very well for how much it would cost, because if we just get them sober, it would mean a great deal. But that was taken care of later on. Thank God. It worked out very well. And there are no problems. Oh, many times, whether they have it or don't, we take them in, because God certainly provides. And a man who gets this program is everlastingly grateful. Doctors, it was hard to understand. Sometimes he'd make rounds and he'd come down and he'd say, sister, let that man go home. He doesn't want this program. Oh, but doctor has a big family and he has this, that, and the other. Doesn't want the program, sister. Is he ready? So he was always right. Many times they'd frighten me and say they'd have a heart attack, or they would tell me they had a bad heart or something. And I hated to bother doctor too much. Often I'd call Ann. I think members of this group, or any alcoholic, should often say a prayer for Ann, because she was the backbone of this. In her calm, quiet way, she was really an angel. I would call and say, oh, Ann, I'm so worried about this fellow. She knew most of them from either reputation or doctor telling about them. And she would get the doctor if it was anything serious, but otherwise she said, now, don't worry about them. Because, well, they're alibiologists, in other words. And I learned they were. They do anything to promote another drink or treatment of some kind. So, well, we take them but once. That was Doctor's plan, too. I thought, oh, my, that's kind of strict, isn't it? But, oh, I see the wisdom of it. Because if there is a merry-go-round, when that temptation comes, you're going to think, well, I can get back in there for 5 or 6 days. Well, that'd be all right. Sister's good. She'll take me back. And I'd only be encouraging my drinking. They know that it's a one-way trip. The sponsors, and as Colonel Towns said, they are. Their cooperation is tremendous. Any hospital who tries to just take them in on their own is very foolish, because they need the sponsorship. I often say it's something like learning the technique of golf. You may know all the angles and all the rules, but unless you get out there in the field and do some footwork and practice, you won't be much of a golfer. So we tried, Dr. felt, if they could be taken out of the environment. At first, it was just 5 days, because people were pretty depleted after the depression and all, financially. And the sooner we got them back to their family, the better. Although many of those first AAs would take them into their own homes and try to help indoctrinate them. They worked in groups. It was marvelous what they did. But however, we certainly have found that it was very wise, because a sponsor will not bring them until they are ready. And then he screens them carefully and goes over it. We want to be sure the sponsor is not just a person they met in a bar somewhere. I usually ask them what groups they're attending. Of course, now I know most of them well, know who are good sponsors and who are not. But it's a tremendous help. So finally, the time came. Well, Anne, of course, died. and 49. And that was very hard for Doctor. He called from the Cleveland Airport. They had just gotten in from Texas, and the plane was grounded. It wasn't Bill. Bill knows more about this than I. Anyway, they brought him directly to the hospital. And we kept Doctor there, too, because he was pretty well shaken up with all this. And Ann died of pneumonia and all that. So, went on from there. Doctor then died in 1950. A year and a half later. He knew then, I believe, that he had a malignancy. He talked with Bill, well, I think that several times a week, if not every other day, he'd give me a little message. And I felt as though I knew Bill and his guiding spirit, too, because there wasn't very much done that they didn't consult together on. Especially anything affecting the foundation of this. Then, one day I got worried. We're just like people in the Army, you know, we go to where we're sent. I often wondered whether I was off the mailing list or whether I was forgotten. I was there for 24 years. Probably 1 week short of 24 years. And finally, the obedience came. So I was to go to charity and work with AA there. They had had AA at charity and fine workers there, but they just had a small department. And Sister Victorine, a very fine sister who everybody loved, was there too. And she came down and we told her everything, and Dr. Bob talked with her. And she really did a good job. But they decided to build a new wing and all the extra. Oh, I know they thought Alcoholics Anonymous was a thrill then or not, but everything was discontinued. It wasn't absolutely a case of life or death. So they just kind of forgot about AA. But Reverend Mother didn't. She saw much good in it, I know. I went there in August, and I didn't hear a word about, other than on my obedience, it said that I was to take care of this floor and visit this patient and work with AA. Well, I knew someday maybe we'd have them. But anyway, I just observed and went along day by day. Finally, one day, I got a call, having the surgery, checking on the patient to see, find out the condition. Then we were worried about this patient, and the bell rang furiously and said, Superior wants you, she's on your floor. And I came down, and the architect of the new building was there, and a few nurses, the director of our nursing service was there, and of course, Perry said, what kind of a setup would you like for this AA? Well, you imagine standing in the middle of the floor and feeling rather strange. I didn't know whether I was at home myself or not just yet. And I couldn't think very fast. So this nurse said, well, sister, are they violent? I said, no, they're not violent. Oh, they're not intoxicated. Yes, they are intoxicated. But they're clear enough to be screened because we must make sure that they want the person. Well, she said to the architect, you won't need those cages then. Well, I said, and Mr. Barton, would you mind give me a few days and we'll draw up a little plan of what we'd like? Fine. Well, the day that they came was on the feature park. Lady of the Rosary, that's how we call it, Rosary Hall. And there is, connected with that, when I was moved there, I thought, oh, I'd love to have this in memory of Dr. Bob. Well, I thought if I get permission, rather than call it the Alcoholic Ward, we'll call it Rosary Hall. And I was thinking of marking their robes, R.H., Well, I thought all I need is a nest, and I have Doctor's initials, R.H.S. Robert Holbrook Smith. So we call it Rosier Hall Solarium. The insignia on the door is R.H.S. Permission to open the ward is granted by a hospital authorities on October 7th, 1952. Peace of the Most Holy Rosary. I feel that to people, whether they're in the church or out, whatever their denomination, when you see a rosary, you know it means prayer. People get the rosary out, well, you think they're praying somehow. So to everyone, I think this is all a result of someone's prayer. The grace of God comes through someone's prayer and penance, that's for sure. Well, anyway, it's a prayer for the main Rosary Hall, Solarium. Well, I told you about that. The insignia eloquently expresses the efforts of the Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine, a Catholic religious order, as they join forces with the members of AA, a strictly non-sectarian movement, in an attempt to rescue men and women of all creeds from the bottomless pit of alcoholism. To be admitted to this ward, you must be sponsored by a member of AA in good standing. You must also evidence a desire not just to get sober, but also to preserve and perpetuate your sobriety on a day-by-day basis. Unless you yourself are willing to admit that you are an alcoholic, you are advised to seek help elsewhere. The physical therapy is the most modern known to medical science. The patient's entire stay is a retirement from the outside world and the habits which have caused his collapse. There are no radios, televisions, newspapers, or magazines. Nothing but AA literature and other literature in keeping with the programs are available. The patient may have no visitors except members of Alcoholics Anonymous, who are welcome between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. The conversation is turned to alcoholism and its ravaging problems. Every evening, a member of AA comes to the hospital to conduct a brief AA meeting for the patients. An attractive coffee bar stands in the center of the hall where AA members and the patients often gather to discuss their common problems. A little oratory is open at all times. Just if they want do some prayerful thinking. It's there. The remodeling and construction work for the solarium was done by members of AA who contributed their time and money. Members who belong to the building trades worked day and night during these spare hours to complete the lovely quarters at no cost to the hospital. Rosary Hall accepted its first patient 1 year ago, and since that date, 1,000 men and women have been hospitalized therein. We haven't much room for women. We're hoping to get more. Oh, we have three. We have three. Sometimes four, and even a stretch to five. But that isn't good. However, the remodel Rosary Hall accepted its first patient 1 year ago, and since that date, well, pardon me for repeating, they have been offered not only the key to sobriety, but also the key to a happy sobriety. The Sisters of Charity and the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who have assisted them decline any individual credit. They are aware that it is in giving we receive. Well, God bless you all, and I wish you a continued happy sobriety. And may God's grace be with you always and bless every one of you. Thank you.
This recording of Bill Wilson was transferred from a record to the tape. He talked at an open meeting here, April 1947. Thank you.
There are two ways of looking at Alcoholics Anonymous. To our friends seated here among us, Alcoholics Anonymous doubtless seems a huge and spectacular success. They may be thinking of us as the people who have won brilliant personal victories by fighting great odds. But every AA in this audience knows his friends give him too much credit that in actuality, his recovery did not happen that way at all. Each in his heart knows that he became too weak to fight alone, that he had to confess his life had become unmanageable and therefore unbearable. He remembers how his power of will to conquer alcohol was crushed, how he finally saw he could never win through under his own strength. Nevertheless, he will tell you that this bitter admission, the hardest a human being can make, was the beginning of his new life, that new life of which this medium is such a glowing and grateful testimony. Hence, no AA meeting can ever be a boast of personal victory. It is, instead, our humble demonstration of that saving grace which all of us have found in a simple reliance on a power greater than ourselves. But, our friends may object, isn't this contrary to most human experience nowadays? Each of you quits the fight. You form into groups, then you help each other, meanwhile depending upon some higher power. We admit it works. We've seen the proof. Still, your philosophy doesn't entirely make sense. How can you win wars without fighting battles? Nowadays, when almost everybody feels he must fight, even to survive, here is the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous telling us, thus proving to the whole world that in their experience they have found a new life only by first admitting they could not personally control the old one, let alone managing anything or anybody else. By what strange paradox, then, has this new strength arisen out of your bygone weakness? Whence, out of complete defeat, comes your astounding transformation? Explain, if you can, the secret of this seeming contradiction, this divine paradox. These are the very natural questions of those who first observe us. Intuitively, our friends sense a mystery. Most of them feel they have seen a miracle. For so powerful has been the alcoholic obsession that all through the ages, few victims have ever survived it. Now comes this wholesale liberation, thousands every month. Is this miracle of recovery due only to the fact that we alcoholics have gotten together, telling each other that we are sick, advising each other to touch in more sufferers, and exhorting each other to be more honest and tolerant? Is that all there is to it? Have we only constructed one more psychological gadget, this time operated by the patients rather than the doctors? Few people who have taken a good look at AA believe this to be the full explanation. Some years ago, a prominent physician was asked to explain Alcoholics Anonymous to a group of his colleagues. Said he, when declining the invitation, "These AAs have assembled many powerful psychological resources. Yet the sum total of these resources does not explain to me the results I have witnessed. In days and weeks, I have seen unbelievable changes in their behavior and motivation. Changes in alcoholics which formerly, if at all possible, should have taken years at best. I can only say this. There is a power at work among these people for which I cannot account. I have to call it the X factor. Most AAs call it God. I have no scientific explanation for this mystery. Like our friend the doctor, MRA will also admit that he cannot fully explain the inner mystery of his own transformation. He can only tell the story of it as best he can, so that others may, if they wish, find their own freedom. Mine is a simple tale to tell, as with countless other thousands who had gone before me down the left-hand path to alcohol oblivion. I came finally to the jumping-off place and could not turn back. It was midsummer, 1934. At a New York hospital for alcoholics, I was lying on one of those green beds of physical and mental anguish we AAs know so well. I had been there before, but this time it was different. This time I had no hope. This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. What a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities, of my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. So I was soon to plunge out into the dark, joining that endless procession who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. No words can tell of the loneliness and bitter despair I found in that morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. Alcohol was my master. Tense and anxious, my wife Lois sat downstairs with a staff physician. That kindly man, Dr. William Silkworth, a medical saint if ever there was one, was trying in his gentle way to explain my alcoholic dilemma to her. "But doctor," she pleaded, "tell me. Don't spare my feelings. Tell me truly, just why can't Bill stop? He has desperately wanted to for these several years. About other things, he always had great willpower and perseverance. He well knows that alcohol means ruin. Oh, tell me the truth, Doc. Why can't he stop?" As considerably as he could, the good man explained how my drinking, once but a habit, had now become a veritable obsession. How my body, which could once tolerate alcohol, had now become highly sensitized to it. Allergic, he called it. So my dilemma was twofold. An obsession as powerful as that of a kleptomaniac to steal. And a physical intolerance to alcohol as grim as that of a diabetic to sugar. The obsession condemned me to drink in spite of myself. My bodily intolerance ensured that I would die or go mad if I kept it up. My only hope, therefore, was the expulsion of my self-destructive obsession, a rare occurrence once it had taken firm hold. At first, the doctor had felt that I might be one of those rare exceptions. But now, seemingly, I was too far gone. I would, he thought, have to be confined somewhere if I were to live very long. Such was my sense, though not told me in so many words. I well knew what it was. I had tried too many times and had failed too often. I had no more strength to resist. I was through. But it was darkest before dawn. For then came a friend with a message. He was an alcoholic who had been relieved of his obsession. He stood before me as living proof of what he had to say. One alcoholic talking to another. He could convince where others could not. Despite my reluctance, for I was an agnostic, I knew I must heed his message or die. Though not easy to take, his message was simple and direct in the extreme. But within its seeming simplicity, it did carry the miraculous power to expel alcohol obsession and catapult me into a new world. In my case, this occurred the very moment I was willing to lay aside my prejudice, admit my personal helplessness, and try, without reservation, what he offered me. Perhaps this is not the time or place to talk at length of my own recovery, of our AA program in detail, or of our astounding growth. This room is filled with fellow alcoholics who know and practice the AA way of life as well as I. The accomplishments of Alcoholics Anonymous are headlined in the press of the world. So I shall be content if I can remind myself and any who would hear that Alcoholics Anonymous is not, after all, a personal success story. It is, instead, the story of our colossal human failures, now converted into the happiest kind of usefulness by that divine alchemy, the living grace of God. For all those who would know us a little better, or who perchance might wish to try our simple method for themselves, I can do no better than leave with them the last seven lines of our book of experience, Alcoholics Anonymous. These lines read as follows. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of the past. Give freely of what you find, and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet more of us as you trudge our road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.